The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Adventurer podcast, where adventurers and explorers tell their stories. Coming up.
What is beauty? You know, over there, beauty means filing your teeth. And they would sort of ask us, well, what's beautiful in your country? What do you do? And we had got into a really interesting conversation where we explained, well, that some people actually make a cut underneath their boobs and they put things in there to make their boobs bigger. And they were just horrified. They were absolutely horrified that we would do something like that, or that there's people that would inject things to make their lips bigger, or like that we would pour hot wax on our bits, our intimate bits of hair, and rip it out. I mean, they just couldn't believe that. They thought it was the most barbaric thing they'd ever heard.
I'm John Horsfall. I'm an adventurer, and here each week I will be talking to adventurers and explorers from around the world who have made remarkable and daring journeys in recent years. From Everest climbers to polar explorers, world record holders, and many more. I hope this podcast sparks ideas and inspires you to explore and go on your own grand adventure. But before we start, if you've enjoyed the podcast, sign up to the monthly newsletter, which is in the description below, where I show you behind the scenes, I do giveaways, and offering you the chance of an adventure. My next guest is a filmmaker and adventurer, produced and presented the Channel 4's Extreme Tribe. She spent 5 months living with the Benjeli tribe out in the Congo, where she immersed herself with her family and became part of the tight-knit community there. On today's podcast, we talk about some of the differences in cultures between the Benjeli tribe, along with her experience of 5 months living with them. It's a fascinating insight into the culture there, and I am delighted to introduce Livia Samoka to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
No worries. Well, I have to say, I was absolutely fascinated with the story about the Benjeli tribe out in the Congo. And I really wanted to get you on to sort of talk more about that. Because for people listening, you spent 5 months with this sort of remote tribe, which is cut off from Congo society or the Republic of Congo. Before we sort of jump into that, let's start with you and how you sort of got into this sort of line of work and these sort of adventures.
So I've never sort of set out to be a TV presenter, and that's not the sort of background that I've come from. So I first and foremost have always been a filmmaker specializing in sort of adventure and anthropology documentaries. And I was a couple of years ago, well, a few, be about 3 years ago now, I was out in Siberia working on a project about woolly mammoths and the Ice Age, and was out there with a bunch of tusk hunters trying to find these incredible woolly rhino and woolly mammoth remains. And as part of it, it was a big recce trip, had to do a bit of filming and to sort of, you know, explain to the broadcaster and the powers that be what we were looking at. And the woman at the time, who was the controller of Channel 4, a woman called Jay Hunt, saw it and said, oh, Livia's like really good on camera, should we ask if she's interested in presenting something? And it isn't really anything that I'd ever thought about, but the thing that I have, you know, been passionate about for years and that I've spent many years making are sort of anthropology programs. And the first thing that sprung to mind was that I've always wanted to go and live with a tribe, and one tribe in particular that I'd sort of had on my radar for about 5 years were the Benjeli. And I'd found out about them through an anthropologist at UCL that I've been, you know, speaking to for years about various different tribes and indigenous cultures. And I was just really, really fascinated with their way of life. And I'd sort of spent probably about 5 years pitching them to various commissioning editors in various disguises, trying to get a project off the ground that could allow me to go and spend time with them. And another thing was that, you know, all the projects that I make, I start from a very early development stage. So I always think of them, get the sort of money from a broadcaster to make them, then go and visit them on the ground, work out who the people are that we're going to film with, and then tell the stories. And as part of that, I've been trying to find a sort of female Bruce Parry or adventurer for years, but as you well know, that whole genre is quite male, white, middle class, ex-army, and so yeah, I mean, the first thing that I thought of was that I want to go and live with a tribe, I want to go and spend time with the Benjeli. And thankfully you know, the channel agreed, and after the various hoops that you jump through, I set off and got out there.
Good. And so how did they take to it? Because you were there for 5 months filming. I suppose it was very much, you know, they were going to be filmed, their lives were going to be opened up to the world. How did they sort of take to that?
So it was 5 months. Well, it was actually 6 months, but we broke it down into three chunks in order to come back and change crew and have various medical checks done. So I went out there for the very, very first time to go and meet with the tribe and to basically ask for their permission to go and live there. That's something that, well, we filmed a bit of it, but it never made it as part of the programme. But it was really to go and introduce myself and say, look, this is me, this is what I would love to do, and really seek their permission and also find the family that I was going to go and live with, which was Akaya and Mama and, you know, the people that you see in the documentary. And then went back out there and did it. It was actually 6 months that was sort of time on the ground, but broke it up into 3 2-month chunks. And they were, I mean, they were, you know, absolutely incredible at the way they just opened up and allowed us to capture their lives. And I think a lot of that was also, you know, it wasn't overnight. It took a little bit of time, as it always does when you're filming with anybody, to gain their trust and to really become part of the family and part of the greater community. But they were incredibly open with, and just, you know, there was no sort of putting on an act or anything like that.
Yeah, because I suppose that was probably one of the questions I was quite intrigued to find out, was because suddenly they had camera crew, because I imagine it was you and what, two or three others or one other?
There was a little group of us. So there was, you know, four translators, because everything had to be translated through two languages. So there was, you know, from English to Lingala, which is the Congolese national language, and then into Bengali, which is the tribal language. So it had to go through two ways. And then a director who was also cameraman, and then a producer who was working with the translators. And then we also had a sort of remote location trauma medic, because we were a good sort of 2-3 days away from the nearest medical facility and the nearest road access. So, you know, in case there was an emergency, we needed somebody that could administer sort of remote trauma, a sort of assistance. But they, yeah, because they hadn't really seen cameras before, a lot of the time at the beginning was we actually would give them the camera so that they could film each other and then play bits back to them, because they were just so fascinated with these big devices that we were carrying around and, you know, what the heck we were doing. So actually it was quite fun for them to just have a look at sort of them filming each other.
And I suppose with that, it was, how do you feel that it was sort of authentic? Because in terms of having that big camera crew following you and following them, did they ever play up to it, or was it very much they just almost, there was a wall between that where they just didn't even think about the cameras? It was just all very real.
Yeah, it was really real. And because I think a lot of the time, you know, if you think about how long we were there and compared to the 3 46-minute programs that you see on TV, there were many days where we would just sit around and not film, and we'd always have a camera nearby, but I'd say the majority of the time we were there and we weren't really filming, or we'd go out into the forest, you know, gathering food or sitting around chatting or preparing food or going around the village chatting to people and bonding with people, and just really becoming part of the community, so that when things then did happen, it was really natural to just pick up a camera and film, and we weren't this sort of odd ones out observing a situation, because we were such a big part of that community.
How, in a sort of community that, which is cut off from the world and Western world, how are the sort of individual roles of women and men within a sort of that community? What were the sort of differences between, let's say, the Western world and the Bengali tribe in terms of the roles?
Yeah. Well, the Bengali are known as one of the most egalitarian societies in the world. So men and women are, and men, women, children of all ages have a real equal standing, which means, but then roles are still divided. So men were very much in charge of hunting, women would take charge of the gathering and more of the food preparation, but then both men and women, depending on when, where and when they were around, would raise the children and, you know, sort of play with them. And actually, even in arguments that would sometimes, as you see in the programme, get very physical, there was no sort of like distinction between you're a man or you're a woman. It's, which is, you know, quite incredible to see, really. And kids that, if they weren't happy or they'd had an argument with somebody in the family, they would just go and sleep somewhere else in the village. They would just move out of the home for a bit. There was an argument between neighbours that got nasty, one family might just decide, oh, I'm going to take off and I'm going to go into the forest for a while, and when I come back, everything's sort of passed.
Yeah, because I watched it, and I suppose what was very noticeable is that they'd have these full-blown arguments, and then a moment later, they were all friends again.
They are, like, the Bengalis are absolute masters at living in the moment. They really, like, they're the epitome of living in the moment, because also they don't, you know, they don't measure distance or duration or time. They don't, that most of them can't count above 3. And so when you'd ask them, you know, how far away is something, or we'd go somewhere, they'd be like, it's not very far away. And then 3-4 hours later, you're still walking through the rainforest. You're like, oh, you know, are we nearly there? Like, yeah, we're nearly there. another 2 hours later, you're still walking. It's they don't measure anything. It's because to them, so like well, I'm going off on one now, but eventually you'd work out not very far away is you can get there and back in a day. Fairly far away is it's an overnight, and quite far away means you're gone for multiple days. But they're really, you know, they really live in the moment, so that when you're having a row with somebody, the row is happening there and then. And then when the row ends, it's sort of forgotten about. And the same if they're having a great time and a great night or a party and they don't want it to end. There's never, ever a case of like, oh, well, I don't know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning now and you've got to get up for work or you've got to go and, you know, hunt a monkey. It's more like we're having a great time. We don't want it to end until somebody is knackered and they're going to fall asleep there and then, you know, like they really live in the moment with their emotion.
And what is the sort of day-to-day life of the people there? Because if there's no time, I suppose they wake up at sunrise and go to bed at sunset, in a sense.
I mean, they definitely don't always go to bed at sunset because they really they do like a good knees up. But life always does begin in the morning at sunrise. And, you know, their life is centered around food and putting, you know, food on the plate for everyone within the family. But that means that kids have to go and pull their weight or get dragged along to go and, you know, forage for whatever might be in season, or, you know, help the women go fishing, or if the men want to go out hunting. But it is a sort of case of sitting around and just in the morning around the fire and working out who is going to do what. But that is what life would centre around. And actually, in terms of number of hours that they work, is actually not very much, because they would go out into the forest and be back again within, you know, 2-3 hours, because they are expert hunter gatherers, and then be back preparing food, gossiping and chatting, having a row with the neighbors or whatever it might be. So in terms of their working hours, they're so much shorter than the hours that we do here. Obviously, much more physically demanding, but yeah.
Did you find there were a lot of sort of similarities between the tribes and the sort of Western culture of, you know, gossiping? And because there was one clip which I saw, well, the one bit that sort of I took was the idea of women in the tribe think it's really attractive to file their teeth down to just a point, whereas, you know, in Western society that's not really done. And then probably what they thought was what you would think is normal in Western society was very much frowned upon in their society.
Of course, yeah. And but, you know, like, what is beauty? You know, over there, beauty means filing your teeth. And they would sort of ask us, well, what's beautiful in your country? What do you do? And we had got into a really interesting conversation where we explained, well, that some people actually make a cut underneath their boobs and they put things in there to make their boobs bigger. And they were just horrified. They were absolutely horrified that we would do something like that, or that there's people that would inject things to make their lips bigger, or like that we would pour hot wax on our bits, our intimate bits of hair, and rip it out. I mean, they just couldn't believe that. They thought it was the most barbaric thing they'd ever heard. And yet to us, the idea of obviously filing teeth isn't exactly attractive, you know.
Well, I have to say, when I was watching it, I was sort of there with my mouth, hand over my mouth, just being like, oh, I can't even see it.
I know, but imagine if that they saw, because we showed them, for some reason, somebody had some pictures on their phone, you know, showed them pictures of somebody having a nose job done. I mean, when you really think about it.
Who has a video of someone having a nose job on their phone?
It's a long story, but also, like, you know, pictures of fake boobs and things like that, that when you actually tell an outsider that that's what is deemed beautiful in certain cultures, they thought it was complete madness.
Good. And what was the sort of moment where she will sort of take away from that sort of 5 months there?
I think the sort of the biggest thing, hands down, is this living in the present moment a lot more and not obsessing about where you are in life or trying to measure that against what you should have achieved, or that like, oh God, you know, late 30s, should be married, you should have kids, should have won a BAFTA by now, or whatever it might be. Is that like, what does it really matter? Why measure yourself against what other people are doing? And just really embrace the moment a lot more. I think that was like one of the biggest takeouts for me.
Yeah, I think everyone can be very, it can be very easy to look at other people and think that they've got, you know, life figured out. But what you really find is that everyone's in the same boat thinking, what are they doing? And that sort of endless thing of trying to, what's the word? You have this sort of idea that you're way, way behind of where you should be. And actually you're doing just fine. And some people, you know, they hit it when they're 30, they hit it when they're 40, and some people, you know, rise up when they're 20 and fall away when they're 30. It doesn't really matter. Everyone's going at their own pace.
Exactly, yeah, because they don't know, like, you know, age or time, so nobody puts any measure on, oh, well, you must achieve this, or I must hunt the biggest monkey that I've ever hunted within the next week. You know, they just don't think like that at all, which I really like. And also another thing that I really love about their way of life is that they only ever take what they need. You know, their life is very minimalistic in terms of their possessions, and they don't put a lot of, I mean, they do want for things, but their life is very minimal. You know, so there isn't this constant desire to sort of have more and order more or have too many supplies. They only ever really take from the forest exactly what they need. And that's like another thing that I guess I've walked away from, of going, I'm really happy in my life and I don't need to go and buy 2-3 pairs of, you know, these jeans or that dress, or I don't need to have a fridge that's really fully stocked, but only really ever having what I need right now. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, of course. I completely agree. It's this idea of, well, you know, in the Western world, it's very much consumer driven. And so I think a lot of people have this sort of keeping up with the Joneses mentality.
Yeah, I hate it. Like that's such a big thing of just like, just be really content with actually making your life a lot more simple and stripping it right back and going, I'm going to use something until it's completely broken and I can't use it anymore, and then I'll replace it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I was wearing my fleece, which I had in 2007 from university, and it's still got like the Edinburgh logo and everything. I was like, it still does me brilliantly. No need to change it.
I love that. I think that's like, yeah, I think a lot of people can learn something from that way of life, of just don't need to have all these things.
And so with the documentary that came out on Channel 4, how was it sort of viewed or taken by the public?
Yeah, it was actually really well received. I was obviously at the time, do you know what? It was not long after, you know, Stacey Dooley had a bit of an incident with the picture of that whole white saviour thing that got bandied about a bit. I was, you know, I did obviously have concerns when it went out, thinking, God, shit, what's it going to look like? A, you know, very white woman going to live with an African tribe. But actually, I didn't, you know, didn't have any criticisms in that regard at all. And I think, yeah, it's really overall really, really positive feedback from it.
I think what I loved about it was you were just there to learn. We had Benedict Allen on a few episodes back, and he very much deals with this sort of immersive documentary style where you're not there to say, oh, you should be doing this, you should be doing that.
I'm not there to preach.
Yeah, exactly. You're just there to observe, and you're just a fly on the wall, observing, learning, and understanding. I think that's probably why it was so well received, was you were very much embracing it, not trying to influence, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, but do you know what, that was tough as well, because I was there for such a long time, and became part of the family and part of the community, and they were, you know, they became my friends, the people that I was living, you know, for God's sake, I turned up and asked somebody, can I come and sleep on the floor of your bedroom for the next 5 months? And they welcomed me with open arms. I mean, I'm not sure I'd react like that if some random person just rocked up at my house and asked to do that. But they welcomed me with open arms. And so obviously I became friends with all the people in the village, and which as a documentary maker, you are there to observe it. But of course, after such a long time and forming personal relationships, you do get sort of drawn into arguments, and you form opinions on when behavior is right or wrong. And so, you know, in episode 2, I think there was the big fight that was sort of ended up breaking up a little bit, because, and I was worried about that when that went out, thinking, God, I'm just, people going to think that I went there and started interfering in people's lives. But actually, it was just a gut reaction that when one of your friends is in a fight, you want to help out, you know. But fortunately, that was sort of, you know, wasn't taken out of context. So,
yeah, that's always the trouble nowadays. And I mean, did you have, in terms of the editing process, did you have any say on it?
Well, because I was, because it was edited in stages, because there were 3 different directors, because trying to get one director to come and do the whole stint would have been impossible. So whenever they came back home, they started editing it already, by which point I was, because I'd only come back for like a week or whatever, and then I'd be back out on location. And so I didn't actually see the program. I wasn't actually editorially involved in deciding what would be in the program and what shouldn't be in the program, which ordinarily I would do. And so by the time I saw the programs, they were right near the end. And but actually, you know, we filmed so much, and there were so many stories that just never made it into the program, that because I'm so close to it, would have been really, really hard to make that decision.
Do you sort of keep in touch, or are you heading back out there again?
No, I'd love to go out, but they are, it's impossible to keep in touch with them, because they're a lot like, you know, a lot of other tribes now have mobile phones, and I spent a lot of time with the Hamar tribe in Ethiopia, and a load of them have got mobile, they're all on Facebook, but the Benjeli are so cut off that there's not a single person that had a mobile phone, or they don't have an address as such, and they're still semi-nomadic. So trying to even write a letter to them, not that they can read, but is sort of impossible. So the only way to really try and get in touch with them would be to go and visit, and is to turn up. And sadly, the last year has not really been possible.
And is the plan to do another style documentary like this?
I don't know. Again, with, you know, COVID in the last year, sort of things got turned on their head a little bit, so I don't know. I'll wait and see what happens.
In terms of sort of preparing for that sort of 5-month stint, did you learn the language, or did you read up quite a lot about the tribe beforehand?
Yeah, so the language is really, really difficult to learn, but I did speak to a couple of anthropologists that had done their thesis with the Benjeli, which is how I found out about them, through the professor at UCL, and sort of, you know, would get basic bits of language from them to just be able to say hello and how are you or good morning and good evening, because obviously when you're living with somebody and sleeping on the floor of their hut, you quite like to be able to say good morning when you wake up. And then with time I picked up bits of the language, but I was by no means fluent.
Because yeah, I'd have thought with that, especially learning a sort of tribal language after 5 months, because you've probably got English speaking camera crew, must have been quite sort of difficult. But in terms of immersing yourself, you probably picked up quite a lot by the end of your 5 month stint.
Yeah, exactly. And also because, you know, the crew were in a sort of separate crew area and I was with the family, and so there were days and hours that I was just on my own with them. So I'd say like it's probably about less than 50% of the time, but I would spend huge chunks of time just on my own with various people in the village and members of my family, which then sort of pushed me to learn the language a bit more, just so that I could communicate on a very basic level.
I suppose, what's the one thing that you probably, would you say the one thing that you've taken from it is living in the moment, or was there something else which you have sort of taken back with you to try and embrace on a sort of day to day?
Yeah, I think that, and the sort of trying to be a bit more simple with life and, you know, using things until they're on their last legs and just trying not to be such a great big consumer.
And in terms of your other projects you've done, because you've done the woolly mammoth, you've done polar bears,
yeah, woolly mammoth.
Sort of been all over the world doing these sort of expeditions. And your focus is very much on, well, actually, when I say that, those two are animals. But it's more on the sort of indigenous tribes and indigenous communities around the world.
That's right, yeah. I've done stuff with various indigenous communities in Alaska and Hamar tribe in Ethiopia. I did a big project with them and created probably about 7-8 years ago a series that we do with Ben Fogel called New Lives in the Wild, which is about which is on Channel 5, which is about people who've sort of quit the rat race, moved to the back of beyond and tend to live quite a subsistence, you know, life off the land, and that's sort of taken us all over the world. So yeah, it's various things like that. And I did a series following the Great Migration through the Serengeti and the Masai Mara, and that involved bits and something with the Hadza tribe. So yeah.
Oh wow. What, in terms of the migration of what, the wildebeest? Or
yeah, that was the wildebeest. And then so we followed them for a year, but we collared it was about eight or nine wildebeest and followed them through the whole course of the migration through the Serengeti and the Masai Mara over the course of the year, and checking in with them at different points on the route, and then looking at how humans sort of, you know, interact and how their lives sort of intermingle.
What, in terms of the crossover between the expansive population in that area?
And it's, you know, with other conservation projects or with the Maasai and the whole lion hunting and how that sort of whole circle of life ties in together, but told through the eyes of the wildebeest on the migration.
Wow. Yeah, it's an amazing part of the world out there.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love it.
And yeah, you've just been out in Kenya, I saw.
Yeah, I was just out in Kenya for a couple of months, and that was working on a few development projects, which, you know, let's see what happens. But yeah, there's a great Hemingway quote, actually. That's, what is it? I never knew of a morning in Africa where I woke up and I wasn't happy. And I think that's so true. It's one of these continents where you wake up and I don't know what it is, whether it's the smell or the sights and the sounds, and you just always like wake up with a bit of a smile on your face.
I think it's the quote on one of my YouTube videos. It's just like, I envy the man who hasn't been to Africa because he has so much to look forward to.
Exactly. Yeah, I love that. It's so true.
No, it's such an amazing place.
Do you know what? I had a year where I was like in and out of Africa the whole year on different projects. And by the end of it, I was like, oh God, you know what? I'm going to have a break from Africa for a while. I need a break because, you know, there's like Africa time and you know what it's like. There's just, it's also a total nightmare to try and work in. And, but yet, lo and behold, after a good 6 to 8 months, I was like itching to get back there.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful part of the world. And yeah, as soon as I have the opportunity to go back, I most certainly will.
Do it.
Well, I have to say, the story of you in the with the tribe has just been absolutely incredible and so fascinating, because very different, and yeah, not many people really get the opportunity to do something like that.
I was like so lucky, and it's one of those things that if I got the chance to do it again and, you know, sort of relive it all over again, I absolutely would. And that's one of those things in hindsight, it's like, oh, did I appreciate it enough at the time? And it's like you want to just soak up every moment.
Well, Livia, there's a part of the show where we ask the same 5 questions to each guest each week, with the first being, on these sort of trips, what's the one gadget that you always take with you?
So I really dislike gadgets. I am... like technologically an absolute sort of moron. I barely know how to work my mobile phone. I sometimes need help turning the TV on. I'm like, I'm really, really bad with gadgets and technology of any sort. So I'm quite anti-gadget, I'm afraid. Does a toothbrush count? I can't go to sleep till I've brushed my teeth. So I'd say like my gadget has to be my toothbrush.
That's perfect. Works every time. A definite must on every adventure, which I'm sure people always might forget to take.
Yeah, there's that. But any sort of other gadgets and Garmins or sat phones, I'm like, oh no, I'd rather just cut off from it all and work it out. As long as I can brush my teeth, I'm happy.
Yeah, we were discussing, I think, a few episodes back and saying I don't like people knowing what I'm doing at the time, if you know what I mean. It's, you know, these people who have like a tracker so you can see exactly where they are at any given point.
I don't want to be tracked.
I'm just like, yeah, terrifies me. I'd rather just sort of get out and sort of immerse yourself into whatever trip or experience you're doing and just completely shut off. Because, you know, as soon as you get back into normal, I don't know, life, then you're plugged back in, and to sort of switch off for a few days, a week or so, is just so blissful.
Definitely. And I think, I don't know about you, but for me, that's the great point about going off on an adventure, is to sort of just turn it all off and, you know, go and explore or go on the journey or wherever that you are going on and switch off from the world. And that's what, when I'm on a production, that's the things that I'm, you know, in a sort of directing whatever and have to keep in touch with the office, that's probably like my weak point, is keeping everyone updated as to what you're doing, because I'm like, oh, I love the bubble that we're in where no one knows what we are or where we are or what we're doing.
And then you've got to go with Patricia from HR and talk about some health and safety.
Or go and report to legal. Yeah, don't like that.
What about your favourite adventure or travel book?
My favourite adventure or travel book? Do you know what? I do love a good, and like the what's it called? The Mammals of Southern Africa book. I love that book. Any sort of encyclopedia or dictionary that tells me what a little biog of the creature. Yeah, I love that. Probably that'd be my go-to book that I take everywhere. Something that I can do a bit of learning on the way.
Why are adventures important to you?
I am one of these people, I get very itchy feet quite very quickly when I haven't escaped. And I think it's just for my like mental health, is just to go somewhere and experience a new place, explore a new area, meet new people and cultures, and find out what makes them tick and how life works for them. And you know, just yeah, different smells and sights and sounds, and just getting out of the world that you know. Yeah, that's the site, sort of what makes life for me. Why is it important for you?
Oh, good. No one's ever repeated the question to me. I've never. Why is it important to me?
It's a hard question.
It is a hard question.
Shiv, like, if that's what you live for, and if that's your passion and your excitement, and like, for me, that's what gives me like my buzz and a spark in my eyes to go out, and that there's sort of entering the unknown.
I mean, I'm going on an adventure, in 2 days' time? And I don't think anything gets me quite as excited as planning it, getting all the sort of gear laid out. I mean, I don't know, you can see on my bed, I've got everything sort of laid out behind me, in the next door room, all the kits sort of ready to go. And I don't know, there's just such a buzz about it. It gets me so fired up. And then as we were saying earlier, it's that idea of disconnecting.
Ill connecting. Connecting
bit of both.
With nature or where you are, and disconnecting from all the bullshit out here.
Yeah, and for me, I'm going paddleboarding down the River Severn, and the excitement of just standing on a board, sitting on a board, and just drifting down the River Severn, which will probably be freezing cold. But I don't know, there's just something so exciting, so refreshing about the whole experience. And it just whether it's difficult, whether it's hard, and the harder the better, because I sort of feel with more challenge and more adversity, you only grow as a person. And by putting yourself into those difficult spots and challenging yourself, you will only grow as a person. Whereas if you just stay in your comfort zone, eventually you'll, I don't know, get very, very bored and become very, very
and
miserable.
And stuck in your ways.
Yeah.
Like, what I really like, and I think this all the time, before I go off on like a big expedition, or just like, do you know what? Even like a random weekend away somewhere, doesn't it? It can be the smallest of expeditions for a day out to climbing up a mountain or something, or a month long, you know, adventure somewhere. Is I always have it on the way there. I'm like, stuff's gonna happen. I don't know what it is. But I know right now that come the end of this expedition, I'm going to be a slightly different person. And I don't know why. Like, I don't know yet what's going to happen, who I'm going to meet, or how it's going to change the core of me. But it will in some way. And I love that, like the unknown.
What about your favourite quote?
Favourite quote. This is really hard because I love a quote. But I'm obsessed with Eckhart Tolle. I love him. The Power of Now, everyone needs to read it. It's my Bible. It's such a brilliant book. And it was actually post Congo that I got really, really into him, when I started getting more into, like, you know, living in the sort of present moment more and being more mindful and all of that. And he's got so many incredible quotes, but one of my favourites is say yes to the present moment and surrender to what is. And I love that. And it's just about being sort of like, you know, the present moment is all that you've got. And even when things are going, oh, and there's another bit quote that he says that I love, which is, what is the problem now? So it's like, even when shit is going wrong, it's like, okay, but what actually is the problem right now? And even when it's all going wrong, it's learning to live in acceptance of it, and sort of like accepting it as if you've chosen the situation, and then either doing something about it or accepting it. And yeah, I really like that.
Yeah, I think that goes back to why adventures are important, because you become very more adaptable to things going wrong.
Definitely. And like sometimes I quite embrace things when they don't go, when it's not plain sailing. Just you a bit, makes you think on your feet.
There's nothing more boring than a story that goes, we went and did this and it all worked fine. And then we came back.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a rewarding story when something goes a bit tits up. You know, I remember like one of the Congo trips, we got out there and it's a nightmare, you know, getting to the village. And we got there and it was pissing it down with rain, and we were trying to, I was helping the crew try and put tents up and keep everything dry, and then everyone pretty much, they all ended up sleeping in one tent for the first night because they couldn't get anything else up, and stuff was getting washed away, and like in hindsight it was very much you know, it's type two fun, and in hindsight it makes such a better story. Type two fun's often a better story.
What's that?
Type 2 fun makes for a better story. So type 1 fun is in the moment when you're having a great time and this is the best time ever, and in hindsight it'll still be the best time ever. Type 2 fun is when you're doing something and it goes a bit wrong and you're not having a great time, but actually in hindsight it was amazing and it makes for a brilliant story. And type 3 fun is when it's really shit at the time and in hindsight it's still shit. But that's quite rare that happens.
I mean, yeah, I'd definitely say type two is the best, because, as you say, that's all the best stories come from type twos.
Definitely.
So people listening are always keen to go on these sort of adventures and travel. What would you recommend for people wanting to get started?
Just do it. Stop overthinking it. And, you know, just get on with it. Stop talking about it. Stop, like, boring everyone with what you're going to do and just book a flight, get on a train, jump in the car, set off on your two feet and just do it. Like, it drives me mad sometimes when people are like, oh, I'm going to do this and I want to do this and this and that. And sometimes, obviously, you understand that it might be, you know, reasons, finances, that they can't do it right now. But I do think that if you're somebody that enjoys an adventure and an expedition, there are things also that you can do that don't cost very much. And I think it's just get out there and do it and don't overthink it. And if you are scared of it, then that's good. Embrace the fear, you know, laugh into the face of the fear and just crack on with it.
I think there was a quote that said, if it's exciting, if you are... Wait, I'm going to butcher this. If it scares you and excites you at the same time, you should probably do it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's like, oh, it's in that Baz Luhrmann song, is it? Or do something every day that scares you. Is that off that song? I might have just got that.
I'm not sure. What's the song?
There's, you know, there's always wear sunscreen.
You're going to have to sing it.
I'm not. I'm a really bad singer. You're going to have to listen to it. I'll send it to you on Spotify. But yeah, do something every day that scares you. If you're a bit scared of it or you're dreading it, then even more so reason to do it. So yeah, my advice would be is just do it. Get on with it. Stop talking about it and just do it.
Yeah.
And there's so many small or even big adventures to be had in the UK or around, wherever you are, local. I'm going on one in a few days, which is, you know, a week long. And then there's Nick Butter, who was on the podcast, who at the moment is trying to become the quickest person to run around the UK.
Wow, that's cool.
Again, I think it's going to take about 6 or 8 weeks.
Amazing.
So
double marathons every day for 100 days is quite something.
That's going to hurt.
Yeah, so, I mean, for people listening, I probably wouldn't recommend that as a start.
No.
But a run into your next door town or
20 miles away or something.
Yeah, or even just like, you know, if you like walking, it's just like go and, I don't know, even if it takes 3-4 hours to get there, just set off and do it.
Finally, what are you doing now and how can people follow you in the future?
I am currently working on a bunch of development projects, for various different documentaries, both in front of and behind camera. And yeah, let's see what happens. Hopefully, sort of, you know, the world is slowly starting to open up a bit, which, and, you know, foreign travel and foreign filming is sort of on the horizon. So yeah, let's see what, I can't really talk about anything sort of in particular that I'm doing, but yeah, let's see what happens in the next 6 months.
All kept hush hush.
Yeah, it's just like nothing's, you know, signed off and in various chats at the minute.
Well, Olivia, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure listening to your stories.
Thank you very much, and good luck on your mission.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the podcast on YouTube now, and don't forget to sign up for our adventure newsletter, which is in the description below. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, tag me on Instagram at John Horsfall. I'm always keen to connect with everyone. I hope to see you next week for another fascinating tale of adventure. But till then, have a great day and happy adventures.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.